Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast ending not with a bong, but with a whimper. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, we have our last episode, which was on the Labour leadership, and in the spirit of Theresa May. Remember Theresa May?
I do.
We're not going to do a running commentary on the Labour leadership contest. We're going to instead focus on what the government's actually been doing. So therefore, in this midweek shot, we're going to sketch out what's happened so far with the government this year and try and see what their agenda is. Boris Johnson, who's our Prime Minister, and regular listeners will know that if we call our Prime Minister Boris, that means we have to make a prediction. So the only way we will talk about Labour leadership races is if one of us asks a leadership prediction question because one of us calls the Prime Minister Boris. Although I think actually the introduction of the Boris forfeit means we have managed to call him Johnson or Mr. Johnson.
Most of the time.
Or Prime Minister Johnson. So there were a couple of
the Prime Minister.
Yes. Boris Johnson spent Christmas on a luxury Caribbean island.
Of course. How very on brand for him.
Like the man of the people he is. It does seem there's a certain leadership style, doesn't it? Which is the same as what it was when he was Mayor of London. Essentially, Johnson acts more like a chief executive. So often will delegate lots of the day-to-day running of government out to his subordinates. In the Parliament, an MP's return last week, it was Defence Minister Ben Wallace who came out and talked about the situation with Iran, not Boris Johnson. So it seems like, again, Johnson won't be doing a Theresa May and speaking in front of MPs for 4 or 5 hours at a time.
Which, to be honest, like there's a lot of things you can say about Boris Johnson, but this, as a kind of a style of leadership, isn't necessarily a bad one. Having the relevant Secretary of State giving the statements on these sorts of things does make a lot of sense in a number of ways. Like, if you've got somebody who knows what they're doing, you delegate that down to them. The issue is, do those people know what they're doing?
That's a bold claim about Ben Wallace.
It is, it really is, but
Johnson did get criticism for not responding to the assassination of Soleimani for a good couple of weeks. I mean, I suppose the question is, what could Boris Johnson have said which would improve the situation? And was it more likely that any intervention by Boris Johnson would make the situation worse?
What most of the criticism of Boris Johnson in regards to the assassination of Soleimani was about was effectively him not coming out and saying extrajudicial killings of people is bad. Like, that's what basically everybody the people who were criticising wanted to hear from Boris Johnson. That was clearly never going to be something that he or any member of his government was going to state. Rather than it being a meaningful criticism, I think it's just, here's an easy stick to beat him with.
So I've just been reading a book about the 1920 US presidential election, which was run by Warren G. Harding. It makes the point that Harding, a bit like Dwight Eisenhower, there were the kind of presidents that were very, very laid back. They go out and play a lot of golf, unlike modern US presidents.
Obviously.
And
what, like Barack Obama?
Exactly. And instead, what they would do is essentially delegate their subordinates to push through their own initiatives. And if those initiatives are successful, you take the credit for them. And if they fail, then you weren't invested in them in the first place, so it doesn't reflect badly on you. In that sense, I can see, yes, you're right, it's not a bad thing to do, especially if you've got the right people to delegate, like Priti Patel and Gavin Williamson.
Oh.
But I suppose my question is, and I don't know the answer to this, but I can see it working in the presidential system. Do you think it works as well in a parliamentary system?
I don't necessarily see why it wouldn't work in a parliamentary system, to be honest with you. As I say, I don't necessarily think it's a bad leadership style. In fact, to be honest, in a lot of situations, like business and things like that, this is in many ways what you want to happen. You generally do want to have somebody who goes, okay, sets the general direction and then says, okay, what do we need to do to make this happen? The specialist comes along and says, we need to do this, this, and this. And then they go, okay, make that happen. And then they go do that. That's an effective way to run an organisation. What you tend to find where things go wrong is when the people who aren't the specialists get really heavily involved in things. From my
Thank heavens that hasn't happened in UK politics over the past 40 years.
Yeah, I know. But given we know who the secretaries of state are for the various departments, from our perspective as left-wingers, that is problematic. But just because we find it problematic doesn't mean it's not efficient or good from the right-wing's perspective.
I suppose my feeling is it will be fine until the press turn. So I think at the moment, when Johnson's still very much in his honeymoon stage and still has, by and large, I think the press, especially the right-wing press on his side, that turns very quickly. It turned very quickly for John Major, turned very quickly for Theresa May. I think now it's seen as him being, as you say, chief executive, in touch, commanding. There will come a time when it will be seen as him shirking responsibility.
Yeah, so most likely example of this to come up in the near future is on the NHS, where there will be bed shortage, there will be something which, you know, A&E times will just be absolutely awful and get even worse, say. And then what you'll find is, because Boris Johnson hasn't been taking control, hasn't been heavily involved in these things, the narrative potentially could shift there to, he's just being lazy, he's shirking his responsibilities, he's just avoiding doing the difficult work.
I mean, one of the reasons Andrew Lansley is quite catastrophically, politically for the government and also for the NHS health reforms, one of the reasons they happened is because essentially David Cameron wasn't paying enough attention to what he was doing. And Oliver Letwin just went, oh yeah, it seems all right. Last week, Matt Hancock, the health secretary, was talking about how, in response to stories about how terrible NHS waiting times were, was talking about scrapping the four-hour waiting time limit at A&E, which feels very Sir Humphrey Appleby. Well, you asked me to reduce the figures, Minister, so we've reduced the figures. Like, we're not meeting the targets, so yeah, we'll scrap the target.
And exactly, and then, but even though the target won't be there, the times will still be being recorded, and then those times across the country will get leaked. And you will discover, and suddenly will discover that it's 8-hour waits in A&Es, which will then turn into a national story. And that's when, potentially, Boris Johnson's approach can fall apart.
And I think, to add on to the NHS issue, an issue that the government will have to talk about at some point is social care. And Boris Johnson gave an interview to BBC Breakfast, because he'll run away from Andrew Neil, but BBC Dan Walker at BBC Breakfast is a bit of a
softer interview.
In which Johnson says, we will at some point deal with social care at some point in this parliament. Which is a little bit lacking on details, to be perfectly honest.
He said previously that he had a plan for social care, which he was gonna reveal, and he hasn't revealed it, but it's going further down the line.
His plan is to get a plan, just as the way to deal with a target is to
scrap the target, yeah. There's another area where Boris Johnson's leadership style can unravel. A good CEO, it will delegate, but they'll still be aware of what's going on broadly. What Boris Johnson is probably doing is kind of going, Priti Patel, you handle this. Ben Wallace, you handle this. I'm buggering off to the Caribbean. At which point, something comes up, and then he has to ask a question about it. He can't provide the answer. And we know Boris Johnson doesn't deal well with details, never mind facts, just details in general, based on
actual thoughts.
Yeah, that's something where he could potentially become undone as well, in that at some point there'll be a major issue, he'll say something wrong, and suddenly it's become a national story. I mean, he's already done this as Foreign Secretary when he said that Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe was there basically teaching
Journalism, wasn't it?
Yeah, teaching journalism or whatever, rather than just over there as a holiday. Yeah.
But he has done this as Prime Minister as well. It's on the Northern Irish border. I suppose the caveat to, yes, okay, Boris Johnson seems intensely relaxed in delegating, but he's also going to take personal charge of a few projects. One of them, which was announced last week, is looking into county lines drug projects and how to essentially eradicate those. Also, The Spectator has hinted that another area he'd want to try and take personal control in is preserving the union. Hence has been rebuffed the SNP's call for another referendum. But then also we've seen power sharing talks resuming at Stormont for the Northern Ireland Assembly. And Julian Smith, who was Theresa May's chief whip, now Northern Ireland Secretary, seems to have done a bit of a heavy lifting there, which makes sense given he seems to have
good relationships.
Yeah, with a lot of the Northern Irish parties because of Theresa May losing her majority. And Boris Johnson basically went over to take the credit. But while Boris Johnson was over there, he again repeated that there would be no checks on the Northern Irish border once the agreement, well, once Britain's left the EU and the deal with the EU and the UK has been ratified. Now, that's not true for longer complicated reasons that we talked about a month ago. So, you know, check our back catalogue. And again, we weren't sure at the time if this was Boris Johnson being lax with details.
Or just outright lying.
Or a mixture of the two. But again, it's a bit of an issue, especially if one of the reasons the government hasn't been able to deal with social care is because Brexit takes up all the government bandwidth. We can't afford to not know what our Brexit policy is.
Yeah.
Mm. The other issue then, I suppose, in terms of foreign policy, again, Johnson was interviewed on BBC Breakfast, as we said. A couple of things that came out of that, revolving around the US administration. Now, we picked our movers and shakers of 2020 at the start of this year. We thought about our wildcard picks. I almost picked Donald Trump as a wildcard, but thought, well, it is an election year. He might be busy. And I suppose he has been busy, but
just not in the way that we thought.
But in many ways, would have been a quite useful wildcard pick. There's the business with Iran, where again, Johnson's got to skirt around the issue of showing solidarity with France and Germany on the Iran deal. And I think Germany, France and Britain put out a joint statement basically saying that Iran was in breach of the nuclear deal. And having to then pivot to buttering up Donald Trump and say, well, he's a great deal maker, I'm sure he can get a great deal. And that's going to be difficult, I think, going forward.
It's not just this particular instance as well involving Iran. Like, Donald Trump has already, well, I say Donald Trump, the United States as a whole has already started trying to kind of leverage Britain into changing its policy in a number of areas. So we have, for instance, the debate about whether Huawei should be involved in building out Britain's 5G network, because Huawei is a Chinese company and there's security concerns there. And the US does not want Huawei to do this because they fear that it's just going to give the Chinese a backdoor access to British communications. Britain has, for whatever reason, come to the conclusion that Huawei is the best vendor for this. Do they change their mind just because the US says they should?
Well, not from what Johnson's been saying. I mean, Johnson got a little bit tetchy in saying, well, he says to any criticism, well, give us an alternative. And again, I mean, it's a wider strategic problem for the UK post-Brexit, which is you need to be part of one of the big trading blocks in the world. So you could be part of China's orbit, America's orbit, Europe's orbit. If we're not going to be part of Europe's orbit, we've got to be nearer America. But then that means signing up to a lot of other things we don't necessarily want to sign up to, like chlorinated chicken and apparently not Huawei.
Yeah, I mean, and the chlorinated chicken thing is another thing which keeps on rearing its head. Like, I think it's the National Farmers Union have already started kind of making like a big deal about this again, basically saying, no, do not allow chlorinated chicken to be sold in Britain. I fully expect to hear an awful lot more about that as we move forward in this year. But yeah, it does demonstrate kind of the tricky position the government's in that Britain is more isolated now than it has been for a good long while. And as a result, people are going to try and lean on us to do things in certain ways that we may not necessarily want to do.
A lot of the collapse of British soft power as well.
Yeah.
There was an interesting Times of India article, I think, on that. I think I've mentioned on this podcast before that the issue with Boris Johnson is not that he's Hitler. The issue with Boris Johnson is that he's Silvio Berlusconi. I can see a situation where a UK loss of influence post-Brexit mixed with a fairly bumbling-looking figure on the world stage leads to a Berlusconiisation quite quickly, if that's a word. It is a word now. That foreign policy aspect is something that we should keep an eye out, definitely,
yep,
over future podcasts. In terms of big decisions then Boris Johnson has to make, we've talked about two of them. So social care, we've talked about there being the decision. We've talked about his remarks on Brexit and the need to balance some of the rhetoric that he's coming out with actually the reality of this trade deal, and we'll talk more on that in other episodes, but just making you aware in case you weren't aware already, listeners. Other thing the government needs to make a decision about is HS2.
Yeah, so HS2 is something which is very controversial down south, pretty much well supported more or less everywhere else.
That's a bold claim.
It is supported by pretty much all the decision makers everywhere else. Because, broadly speaking, they can all see the benefits of having additional capacity going from London up to the Midlands, and then as we expand HS2 to the north in future. The issue is HS2 is proving, well, has always been controversial amongst all kinds of different areas, both left-wing and right-wing. Anytime you end up talking about public transport policy, someone always suggests scrapping it. And then, you know, reinvesting that money into something else like electrifying rails, the rails up north or in a certain area, which hasn't been seen any investment for 35 years or whatever. Yep.
I love you talk about the north like it's a generic area. What would Andy Burnham say? What would Lisa Nandy say, Steve?
I'm not talking about towns, so...
no, because there's no towns in the north.
No, absolutely not.
It's just a homogenous blob. They all look the same. You just pitch the Coronation Street theme tune and a cat going across
pretty
the
much.
Room.
Yeah. Yeah, HS2 is something which is... like the Conservatives especially, their grassroots don't seem to be very fond of it, but it's already been built, or it's in the process of being built. The work has started. To cancel it now would be an interesting decision, to say the least. And you then have to answer a whole stream of other questions about rail capacity and other things of which the government probably don't have easy answers to. Whilst the government needs to make a decision, I suspect they'll just continue on with it. If for no other reason than, to be honest, because if they cancel it, it puts Andy Street's position as mayor of the West Midlands in danger.
Well, so this is the political issue for the Tories, isn't it? Especially for the Tories. HS2 is quite interesting politically because HS2 goes through a load of rural Tory seats. I think it's why people like Cheryl Gillan,
yeah,
very anti-HS2. And so on the one hand, you've got lots of Tory rural constituencies with lots of political heft who are going to launch very strongly worded letter campaigns to the Daily Telegraph. On the other hand, as you say, Andy Street, Mayor of the West Midlands, one of the biggest races that's happening in the country in 3.5 months' time. And Andy Street has been very clear on the need for HS2. And if the government was to scrap it between now and the election, it would be a massive kick in the teeth.
Yeah, and it would also be a massive issue and politically much more wider than that. When Boris Johnson won the election, he basically said to the kind of like the former Labour voters that had turned out for the Tories this time round, and said, "I do not take your votes for granted. I am going to do things to actually benefit you." One of the first major decisions he does, he cancels investment into the Midlands, makes it even more difficult for future plans for investment in the north to happen. Well, suddenly that's a very big stick which he can be beaten with.
A railway sleeper, in fact.
Yeah, but yeah, so HS2 is something which, if he does cancel it, probably becomes emblematic of a potential betrayal narrative of those kind of former Labour voters, or at least it prevents the opportunity to build one.
We'll try and keep tabs on the things we've talked about in future episodes. If you would like to influence the kind of content we talk about, you could become a Patreon subscriber.
You can indeed. You can go to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne and you can join our merry band of supporters, which will give you access to additional content, early access to content, the opportunity to kind of like fill in a few bits and pieces to kind of help shape some of the content that we produce. Well, lots of nice things.
We had promised shout-outs to Patreon subscribers, hadn't we? And we haven't done it yet.
Yeah, we are obviously still in the early days of all of this because there's a couple of bits and pieces on there which we haven't had a chance to enact yet. So do bear with us. Once in full gear, we will kind of like start with everything, but we are aware that there's a few bits and pieces.
But there are blogs up there that aren't published anywhere else. There's episodes there not published anywhere else. And all our Patreon subscribers, myself, Steve, and all the boys in the band would like to know that we think you are all very beautiful and we do love you madly. We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com /notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. Dave Tepper composed our theme tune. You can follow James Cram at Twitter @JamesCram. You can follow me at Twitter @PaperbackRioter.
You can follow me on Twitter @AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.